Good morning, everyone. I also appreciate how you all were not afraid of that rain. It was not going to slow you down this morning. The mist, you did it. The San Clemente mist, I'm still getting used to it. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to my online crew. If we haven't met yet, hello, my name is Amin. I'm one of the pastors here on staff. Excited to be with you today. All right. Today, we're talking about this fun topic called comparison. And comparison is this interesting thing. I've been kind of studying it and thinking about it for a few weeks, and I'm realizing that we compare things all the time. This is just a very natural part of our lives and our day. As you were walking in today, you were comparing the different donuts to see which one had more sprinkles versus the other one. When you go to lunch today, you will just subconsciously be comparing the sandwiches and the salads, trying to figure out what you're gonna get. If you're like my wife, you'll go to dinner and you'll look at the menu and choose your entree based on comparing which sides come with which entrees. Does she want the mashed potatoes or the french fries? We go to really healthy dinners. But comparison is just a very regular part of our life. When I was growing up, I don't know if you guys remember this magazine. I'm going to date myself. This magazine called Consumer Reports. Anybody remember this? It's a website now. I don't know why 9-year-old Amin was fascinated by the Consumer Report magazine. I would go to the library, I would check it out. You could check out magazines at Ivanhoe Public Library. I'd get Sports Illustrated for kids, I'd get Consumer Reports, and I would just rip through that thing. And it was literally just comparing products. And back then, it was like cordless phones and answering machines and boomboxes. I'm like, oh, what a neat cordless phone, and all the reviews and the pros and cons. So comparison shopping is something we do. Now we just often Google it and kind of figure out what's the right product for me. Before you go on vacation, you compare. Where are we gonna go? What are the things we can do if we go there? What are the right flights? What are the right hotels? So comparison is just a regular part of our life. It's often, at times, it's neutral. We do it without thinking. At times, it can actually be beneficial and helpful to us as we're making decisions. But there is a line. And there is a threshold. And when we cross that line of that threshold, comparison no longer is helpful. In fact, it can be quite hurtful. And it can actually become a destructive part of our lives that not just impacts us, but will also impact our view and our relationship with Jesus. And so what is that line? What is that threshold? That's what we're going to focus on today. The name of the message this morning is called The Comparison Trap. And the subtitle, what we're going to look at, is how to know if you've gone too far. So if you have a Bible, you can grab it. We're going to spend our morning in Matthew chapter 20. You can follow along. Obviously, the verses will be behind me. In Matthew 20, Jesus is with his disciples and the followers and the crowds. And in Matthew 20, he's going to tell a parable, a story, because what Jesus has been trying to do is help his followers and disciples and the crowd understand the differences between the kingdoms and the structures of the world versus his kingdom and the kingdom he was inviting people into. And so Jesus uses all kinds of methods to do that, and in this case, he's going to use a parable, a story, and he's going to use things that they would readily understand. This was a farming culture, so he talks about vineyards and workers and laborers and trees, and Jesus loved using those metaphors because the people would be like, yep, I totally understand what you're talking about. And so this is the parable that we're going to look at this morning. We're going to start right in verse 1. Jesus says, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard." And the story begins simply. This landowner needed some workers on that day for his land. He went to go hire some day laborers. This is, for us, the equivalent if you've ever gone to Home Depot and you see the people kind of waiting outside and they have signs and they are people that are willing to work and help you with whatever DIY project you're about to jump into. If you need stuff hauled away or landscaping help or help building something, these people will help do that for you. They have skills, they have a desire to work, they just have no work in front of them. And that's exactly true in this time, that there was people who were ready to work, willing to work, there was just no work for them to do. And so they're just waiting, and they're just hoping that somebody would hire them at some point. this vineyard worker owner goes out and he hires these workers, and it says that they agree to the pay. They agree to a denarius pay, which is really just a day's wage. They agree to get a full day's wage for a full day's work, which for you is like, yeah, of course, that's what they're going to do. They're going to work the whole day. But again, there were so many people desperate in need for work that you could have obviously negotiated the price down. They would have accepted half a day's pay for a day's work. But the landowner was fair and says, I don't want to hire you just for an hour or two. I want to hire you for the whole day, and you'll be compensated as such. And so they go, and they go to the vineyard, and they begin working. Verse 3, and going out about the third hour, so about 9 a.m. now, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And he said to them, you go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right, I will give you. Now notice he doesn't negotiate the pay. He just says, I'm going to pay you what's fair. And for these workers, that would be perfectly fine with them, because again, now it's 9 a.m. The majority of the people getting hired have been hired. There was very little chance anybody else at 9 a.m. was going to get plucked and hired and brought to the vineyard. So they were just lucky to have some work. And they recognize, well, we don't deserve a day's pay. We'll kind of just take whatever at this point because we're just happy to have something today. And so they went. Going out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same. And about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing. And he said to them, why do you stand here idle all day? And they said to him, because no one has hired us. He said to them, go into the vineyard too. And when the evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last, meaning the ones that were just hired, up to the first. And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. Now, when those hired first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius, a day's wage. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house, saying, these last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat. But he replied to one of them, friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last worker as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with my belongings to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity? And then Jesus ends the parable by saying, so the last will be the first and the first will be the last. A phrase he's been saying over and over to his disciples and followers, trying to give them a picture of his kingdom. And so just imagine for a moment that you were one of the workers hired at the 11th hour. At 5 p.m., the day ends at 6. I mean, your day is shot. You never thought you're going to find work that day. You happen to find this person. He tells you to come. You go. You work for an hour. And when payment comes, you expected little to nothing. And yet you got the full day's wage. Imagine how that would have felt for you, this unbelievable generosity, this unbelievable gift that you were given. Same with the workers that show up at 3 p.m. and noon at 9 a.m. All were given a full day's wage. What an incredible gift by the landowner to these workers. And then you get to the ones that were hired at 6 a.m. See, you would think in their minds that they would just be fully satisfied. When they woke up that day, their hope was this: I hope I get hired. Step one. Step two, I hope I get hired for several hours, not just 1 hour or 2 hours. I hope I can work the majority of the day and get paid for it. And the last step, I hope I get close to a full day's wage. Right? That's the hope when they woke up and they go stand outside and they wait for work. And guess what happened? They were hired, they got to work a full day, and they got a full day's wage. Everything they'd wanted when the day started, they had achieved and accomplished. And so you think when the payment comes, they'd be like, great, this is what my hope was today. Yet instead, they begin to grumble. Their satisfaction shifted to dissatisfaction. And the only thing that had changed from the time they stopped working until the time they received their payment was they began to notice and compare what they had received to what others got. And when they began comparing what others began to receive, it shifted their satisfaction to dissatisfaction. This is point one on the outline of the comparison trap. How do you know if you've gone too far? When you move from satisfaction to dissatisfaction, when you begin comparing things and suddenly you are no longer satisfied with what you have, and that comparison moves you to places of dissatisfaction. I was talking to a friend of mine this week, and he's in advertising. And he's like, the entire point of advertising, commercials, the ads you get on your phone, all the things, the entire point of advertising is to make you feel dissatisfied. That you're sitting at home, you see a commercial for this brand new car, and you look at all the features, all the things the car can do, and this car is amazing, and they want you to be sitting there now and comparing this car to the car I have. And the desire is that you would now say, I am very dissatisfied with my car. I wasn't even thinking about my car today, but this commercial made me think about my car, and I'm dissatisfied. And the promise is, well, buy this car, and you will now be satisfied again, right? And my friends, this advertising works like a charm on me. I am such a sucker for this type of advertising. I am constantly seeing stuff on Instagram, on TV, and I'm like, I think I need that. Well, that looks pretty good. Michelle's like, when was the last time you sawed anything? I don't know, but that saw looks solid. I think I need to have one. I'm a sucker for that. I'm a sucker for technology and toys. I have been my whole life. I'm a loyalist. One of my brands is Apple. I've been an Apple guy since I was in high school. Love Apple. My first computer in college was the Apple Mac G4. A bit extravagant for what I needed, but you know, that was my first computer. I wish in high school I would have actually invested money in Apple stock. It would have been much more fruitful for my life than all the money that I keep throwing at Apple each and every year for all their products, but here we are. And since high school, Apple would do this thing where they would put on this conference every single year, and now they do it several times a year. One is tomorrow at 10 a.m., where they would, I'm not kidding, when they would show off their products and say, look at this new cool thing we have. And one of those events every year is for the new iPhone. And I, of course, watch it. Monday mornings, 10 a.m., they put the new iPhone out. It's going to happen in a few months, the iPhone release. And I will watch this basically commercial for an hour with all the new features. And I will be sitting there playing with my iPhone 15, which is the newest iPhone you can buy, and I'll be like, well, this is no good. This phone that I didn't even think about 10 minutes ago, now I'm very dissatisfied with this phone. And the irony is the features they're even showing off have nothing to do with my life. They're like, oh, the camera is 5 times better. I'm like, ooh, I never do anything with my photos. Michelle and I go on vacation, I take photos of buildings, and then I stare at them, and then we move on with our life. But man, am I happy that the camera is better. Oh, it's faster, great. ESPN might load in a second now instead of a second and a half. Thank goodness. But this is just a common part of our lives where advertising or things, we'll start comparing them, and we can become very dissatisfied with the things that we have. The harder one, the more challenging than one in our life, is when we begin comparing ourselves and our lives to the lives of others around us. See, this is the tricky one. And whether it's people in our life, our family, our siblings, whether it's friends of ours, whether it's people at school or coworkers, whether it's people in our community, whether it's people in our church, and now we're at a state where we can be on Instagram and we are looking at things of people we've never met before and we're staring at them and their lives and we can become very dissatisfied comparing our perception of their lives with what's before us. And there's no shortage of examples of what happens when we begin comparing ourselves to others and the things that can draw us out from there. I mean, finance is one, right? Money is the easiest one. You start looking at where you live and the car you drive and the things you have, and you look at what other people have, and suddenly you become very dissatisfied with what you have in front of you. For the majority of us, if you think about wherever you're living right now, whether it's, you know, in somebody's home, or if you have a studio apartment or a home or a condo, whatever it is, wherever you're living now, for the majority of us, when you first moved in, you were pretty excited. And you're like, oh man, I'm so happy we found this place. I'm so happy we have this. This is great. And you're excited. And as time goes on, it starts fading. And then you'll go to a friend's house and you'll go see their apartment and they have this nice yard, or you'll go to somebody's house and they have this great place to entertain, and you come back home and now you start getting dissatisfied with the place that you're living when you start comparing it to others. You save all year and you plan for a vacation and you're so excited and you go on this vacation and it's great and it's everything you had worked for and saved for. And you come back home and you're excited to tell people about it, but then you start hearing about their vacations and you start seeing on Instagram other vacations people have gone on. And now this vacation that you were so excited about, as you start comparing it to what other people are doing, you can become very dissatisfied, right? So finances and things can become a source when we compare it to others. I think the season God has us in can be a source of dissatisfaction if we begin comparing it to others. Things like if we are single in our life right now, and yet we start seeing our friends start coupling up and getting in serious relationships and getting engaged, suddenly we can start becoming very dissatisfied that the season God has us in is being single. Or if we're married and we can't have kids, or we're struggling in that area, and yet we see our friends and they're having multiple kids, and we begin to look at our life and comparing it to the life of our friends, we can suddenly become very dissatisfied. Or we get around the holidays, and you see the Instagram posts of the family, and they're all wearing matching sweaters, and they're all smiling, and they look crazy, and you're like, oh my gosh, look at this family, they look so perfect, and look at my life. And I think about Christmas for us, and we're just trying to survive and get through, and we're not gonna get together as a family, and we're gonna try to avoid more drama. And yet when I compare my life to the season God has me, and I look at the life of others, I can become very dissatisfied. Finances can do it, family dynamics can do it, and it can happen in our faith. See, this is what Jesus is talking about. Remember, he is trying to give them a picture of heaven. This is what the kingdom of heaven looks like. And he is saying, here's what the rest of the world would tell you, that if you came at the 11th hour, you should get less. And if you were there from the beginning, you should get more. You've earned it, you deserve it, you're better. That's the structures of this world. And that's how you want me to operate. But I'm telling you that my kingdom says, whether you've been following me since a baby or you just cried out to me in desperation, you don't even know what it means to know me and follow me. My love is poured out on both of you equally. My grace is poured out on you both equally. My forgiveness is poured out on you equally. See, I have no hierarchy in how I operate, not in my kingdom. And yet what you want and the structures you have in place tells me if you came in at the 11th hour, yeah, you might get in. But come on, we're the real ones over here. And so this began to happen among the disciples. This happened in the early church. So there was a group that were like, hey, we were with Jesus from the beginning when he was alive. You just heard about Jesus after he died. So yeah, you might be in, but come on, you're not like us. We have more of the honor. We have more of the esteem. We have more privilege. We're the real, real Christians. Oh, we were Jewish like Jesus. You guys are Gentiles. You don't even know the hoops we've had to jump through. Or I go to church every week. I'm in all the Bible studies. I'm in leadership. I'm an elder. I'm a deacon. I give more. I serve. I do all the things. And yet when I look at somebody else's life who barely shows up to church, it looks like they're receiving God's blessings more than I'm receiving it. So when I compare the blessings God has given me to them, and I'm doing things the right way, I can suddenly become very dissatisfied with what God has put in front of me. See, the danger of comparison when we cross that threshold isn't simply that we become dissatisfied, although that is a problem. The real danger is what it reveals in us, is that our hearts are not oriented in a manner of thankfulness and gratitude. That's what starts getting revealed in us. It's not that just that we get dissatisfied, is that it is exposing our hearts and that our hearts may not be operating from places of deep gratitude and thankfulness. Look at the response of the laborers when they got their money. It says they began to grumble. They didn't say, thank you, this is what we asked for, we got what we received, this is amazing, awesome. Okay, can we negotiate a little bit more, just what you hear me? Like, they didn't do any of that. They just immediately began grumbling. They became more fixated, not on what they had received, but on what others had received and what they thought they deserved. See, their blessings got lost because now it was more about what others were getting. Number one on the outline, how do we know if we've gone too far, if we go from places of satisfaction to dissatisfaction when we begin comparing ourselves to others? And how do we combat it? It's that posture, that heart of thankfulness and gratitude. Because if we are operating from that place, then our eyes are focused on the big picture and what's in front of us and the work that God is doing in our life versus what he's not or what we think he should be or what we think we deserve. So we become people that are focused with gratitude, not because our lives are perfect, not because there isn't sin and brokenness and hurt and pain in the world and in our lives. No, those things are gonna be true. But in the midst of that, how do we remain having a posture of gratitude and thankfulness for what God is doing and what he has done in our life? That's the first one. Let's continue on. Is everyone with me? You feeling good? All right. Didn't know if I scared anybody. Verse 20. Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee, which are James and John, and all right, that's a cool nickname. I guess you guys can rock that. The sons of Zebedee, James and John. The mother of James and John came up with her sons, kneeling before him, meaning Jesus. She asked for something. And he said to her, "What do you want?" She said to him, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left hand in your kingdom." She is operating, and James and John are operating from the structures and the kingdoms of the world. Because in those structures and kingdoms, if you are in a position of power, if you are the king, the people who are also important are sitting at your right hand and your left hand, right? They're propped up. They have esteem. They have honor. They have more money. They'll get more acclaim. Those are great seats to be in. Those are great positions of power to be sitting on the right hand and the left hand. So for James and John, who brought their mother with them to help plead their case, which... I won't go too much into that. I mean, I've been guilty of it myself. But for James and John, it was not enough that Jesus had called them and invited them. It was not enough that Jesus had said, "Come and follow me." It was not enough that they were with Jesus, living with him, sitting at his feet, getting his teachings, his love, his blessing, his forgiveness, his compassion. It wasn't enough that they're one of the 12 disciples. They wanted one step more. See, they wanted to win. And winning in the structures of the world means power and authority. That I am one step above you. That when I compare myself to you, well, this is weird, I am a little bit higher. That's what winning means. That I am up, therefore you are down. The second point on the outline of the comparison trap, how do you know if you've gone too far? When you always have to win. When you're always concerned about winning, when you compare yourself to others, am I ahead? Am I ahead of where those other people are? What James and John wanted was to sit at Jesus' right and left hand because they thought in the structures of the world, they're gonna have more authority, more power than the rest of the disciples and everyone else. And that's the seat they were vying for. It wasn't good enough just to be invited in by Jesus, but they had to win. I'm gonna continue the story. Verse 22, Jesus answered, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" They said to him, "Sure, we're able." He said to them, "You will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and my left hand is not mine to grant, but is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father." You don't get it. You don't get it, James and John. You don't get what you're asking. You don't get the kingdom I'm inviting you into. It doesn't look like the kingdom of this world. In my kingdom, in my house, the pathway of being great is a life of service and sacrifice and suffering. The road that I am on is taking me to the cross. That's the cup I'm gonna drink from. So you wanna be at my right and left hand? You wanna be on the cross next to me on the right and the left? I didn't think so. See, you think my right and left hand is places of power and esteem and privilege, and I'm telling you, it means you are the ones that are seeking to love and to sacrifice and serve others with your life. That's power in my kingdom. You don't know what you're asking. I love this part in verse 24. And when the 10, so the other 10 disciples, they caught wind of it, when they heard, they were indignant at the two brothers. Now, scripture doesn't say this, but my belief is the 10 were not upset because they're like, "Oh man, James and John, you missed it. oh, James and John, how could you be so dumb? Don't you know the kingdom is about suffering and sacrifice? And don't you understand that? You guys are so off base. Oh, man. I don't think that's why those guys were upset. I think the 10 are upset because James and John beat them to the punch. They jumped out ahead of them. Oh, we're already vying for positions. We're already jockeying for positions. Shoot, they got out ahead of us. They're trying to get one up on us before we could get one up on them. It wasn't that James and John were asking for them all to be at the table with Jesus. No, just us. There's only two seats. There's only so much of the pie. And when the other 10 heard it, they were furious because they wanted to be in those seats as well. So everyone's upset. The mother's upset, I'm sure. And so Jesus calls them all together. And he said to them, you know, disciples, you've lived under this, you know the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. You know this. Don't you guys know this? Don't you know how the world works, that people get in power and they lord it over others? They put people down. They claw, they step over people. We want power, we want authority. Once we get there, we don't want to let it go. So we're going to make sure people stay below us, they stay underneath us. We're going to make sure everyone knows when I walk in a room that I'm in charge and you're not. I'm in the position of power and privilege and you aren't. Everyone's going to know my status because it's going to be slightly above you. So when I compare myself to others, I'm getting on top. Jesus is like, you guys know how the world works. You know you've sat under this. You know you've experienced this. And I'm sure many of you in this room have sat and lived under that type of kingdom where people lord authority over you in a manner to continue holding you down while propping themselves up. You know, verse 26, it shall not be so among you, not in my kingdom, not in my house. That's not how we operate. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. And who would be first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. That's greatness in my kingdom. That's the life I'm inviting you into, a life of service and sacrifice and suffering along the way. That's power. You all know better. That's not how my kingdom operates. See, and it's the posture of the heart, right? This desire to just be on top, to win, to get ahead of people. And Jesus is saying, I'm inverting my kingdom. I've told you time and time again, the first should be the last and the last should be the first. So how do we practically live into that? Paul articulates it so beautifully in Philippians chapter 2. And Paul just begins by saying, do nothing from selfish ambition or vain conceit. Start there. Start your day saying, today I'm going to do nothing out of selfishness. I'm going to do nothing out of my own personal agenda and ambition. I'm going to do nothing to try to get myself ahead and over other people, to lord authority over them. Do nothing out of selfish ambition and vain conceit. All right. And in doing so, you will become people that begin considering others better than yourselves. And you'll begin to look out not just for your interest every day and your agenda and your needs and your desires, but you will become a type of people and community that seek out the interest of others. That's leadership in my kingdom. It's not bad to be a leader. It's not bad to be in charge of things. But what does your leadership look like? What does the kingdom that you are trying to create look like? And does it align to the kingdom that Jesus is inviting you into? See, the comparison trap is real. We compare things all day long. Some of them are neutral, some of them are really helpful for us, and some of them can become really harmful and can damage us and damage our relationship and view of Jesus. When we begin to become people, they move from satisfaction to dissatisfaction. If we're discontent all the time with what's in front of us, that might be a warning sign that you're falling into the trap. And if you're somebody and you always have to win, you always have to be one step above, you always have to let all your friends know that you're doing slightly better than them, you always have to grab any ounce of power and hold on to it tightly, it could be an indicator, a warning sign that you're falling to this trap. The good news is we have things to combat it. And again, it begins with that mindset and that heart that we want to be people that live and operate from places of gratitude and thankfulness. I have a friend of mine, and he takes the train to work. He lives on the East Coast. That'd be weird in LA if he takes the train to work. He lives on the East Coast. He takes a train into the city to work. And he started doing this thing, and I just kind of caught it through Instagram. On his note app on his iPhone, Apple iPhone, he jots down three things that he's grateful for on his morning commute. They're often small things. They could be silly things. It could be I got my iced coffee. It could be something with his family. It could be bigger things, meaningful things. But he just jots down three of them. It takes him a minute. And every few weeks, he goes back and reviews the last few weeks of, like, what are the things that I've been grateful for? And it's just a small, simple step to begin orienting our hearts towards what does it look like to be thankful and grateful. It's so easy to say, yep, I'm gonna walk out of here, I'll be more grateful. I'm gonna be grateful for the parking spot I got, I'll be grateful for the lunch I get, sure. What does it really mean for us to orient our lives towards a heart and posture of gratitude? What does it look like to say, I'm gonna pay attention to the blessings in my life, no matter how difficult it might be in this season, and the way God has blessed me in the past? So whatever looks like, whatever that looks like for you, whatever steps that you need to take, take them. Because here's the good news. The second part then becomes a whole lot easier. Because the natural overflow, if you are people that are operating from places of gratitude and thankfulness, is it's much easier to look out for the interests and the needs of others. If you have a heart of gratitude, you don't wake up thinking about your agenda, what can you do and what are your needs and how do you get all the credit. No, your heart begins to shift and change and you begin paying attention to others. And what are the needs of the others around me? And how can I help find wins for other people today? How can I be someone that doesn't take the credit but gives the credit back freely? How can I not be so concerned about my vacation but I look at this person who hasn't been able to take a day off? How can I bless them maybe a little bit and give them a win in my life? See? If we're operating with gratitude, we become what Paul is calling us to become. That we begin thinking of the needs of others first. And just think of what a community will look like that day in, day out operates with that type of heart and posture. So let me pray for us, church. Jesus, we love because you loved us first. That in the midst of our brokenness, in the midst of our sin, when we didn't know you, when we were far from you, you pursued us and you called us and you loved us and you never gave up on us. And I will put myself in that category of the 11th hour, Jesus. You found me when I was in the 11th hour and I cried out and you offered me your love and your mercy and your forgiveness. And I've been trying to understand since that day what it looks like to love you and serve you and step into the kingdom that you've been inviting me into. Father, I pray for this room that this would be a community that takes seriously what it looks like to operate from places of thankfulness and gratitude, recognizing all that you have done in our lives and continue to do. God, would you open our hearts? Would you change our hearts? Would you melt our hearts? Would you open our eyes to new possibilities of what it looks like to push up against what the world is telling us and say, not so with us, not in his kingdom, not in this house, but we are gonna seek to love and to serve others and point them to the one that can transform lives. Jesus, we thank you for your love. We thank you for your forgiveness. We thank you for the blessings. We thank you for knowing us. We thank you for your sacrifice. Father, we love you. Amen.